I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with two great friends and colleagues, Rameshwar Dass and Roshi Joan Halifax, PhD. So I just realized I should probably call her Dr. Roshi in this day and age.
Don't.
We're in conversation today about the amazing new book, which was just released in January of 2021, Being Ram Dass, co-authored by Ram Dass and Rameshwar Dass, also known as Ramesh, to his friends. Ramesh has been navigating a spiritual path for 50 years. I believe Ramesh was actually known as Jim when he was at my very first retreat in January 1971. So
that's correct.
We've known each other a while. Now, Ramesh met
Ram Dass. I was known as Joan.
Yes, Dr. Joan. Ramesh met Ram Dass in 1968 and spent time with Neem Karoli Baba in India from 1970 to 1972. He's worked as an artist, photographer, environmentalist.
If you'd gotten on the bus, you would have joined us too.
Oh, I know. Well, that's a whole story too. Maybe we'll get into that. You and I can both tell that story from different angles.
Definitely.
Ramesh has worked as an artist, photographer, environmentalist, and writer, and collaborated on many projects with Ram Dass over the years, including the original Be Here Now. Also here today for this podcast is my great friend, Roshi Joan Halifax, PhD, who is a close confidant and colleague to Ram Dass throughout his life. Roshi is a Buddhist teacher, Zen priest, anthropologist, and pioneer in the field of end-of-life care. She's the founder, abbot, and head teacher of Upaya Institute and Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. A beautiful, beautiful place. She received her PhD in medical anthropology in 1973 and has lectured on the subject of death and dying at many academic institutions and medical centers around the world. Roshi is the author of several books, including her most recent title, the 2018 release, Standing at the Edge. Welcome to the podcast, both of you. It's so great to be talking to you.
Yeah, Sharon. It is the miracle and, in a way, the silver lining of a very strange time in our world.
Indeed. So I have a hardcover copy of this book. I'm reading it on Kindle. And
does that have the photos in it?
Yes. Cool. But it's a giant book.
And it's so beautifully produced.
It's really fabulous.
I mean, the photo on the jacket is
yes.
unbelievable. It's just like, it is loving awareness. So RD. How did you pick that image of the many photographs of him?
Did you take this photo, Ramesh?
It is one that I took.
Yeah.
And, the intention was really to grab people across a bookstore aisle. But of course, there are not too many bookstores open right now. But anyway. Yeah.
It's really gorgeous. So maybe we could start. Ram Dass has played such a central role in each of our lives as a friend, a mentor, a colleague. Maybe we could start with each of you sharing a little bit about how you first met RD. So you, Ramesh, did you actually meet him when you were at Wesleyan as a student?
Yeah, but Roshi met him earlier than I did.
Oh, really?
She knew him when he was Richard.
Oh, let's start with Dr. Roshi then.
Well, you know, long story, but in a few words, I was married to Stan Grof, as some of you know, who was a pioneer in the field of LSD research, particularly around issues related to death and dying, but also addiction. And also, you know, Stan worked in Czechoslovakia with artists and with psychotherapists. And so, needless to say, Ram Dass and Tim were doing something the same, but also different, really different. So Stan is, you know, at that time, and I think still, has this incredibly curious mind and is open to everything. So we had this meeting with this really edgy, wild, funny, super smart pioneer in the field, and that was Ram Dass. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of it was around psychedelics, and part of it was around end of life. You know, he was really interested in states of consciousness and had this sort of the seed that was growing into a forest, if you will, inside of him that was related to care of the dying. So I loved him, I have to tell you. You know, Stan's a really interesting person, but he wasn't that much fun. And we're still friends, by the way.
Yeah.
Lifetimes later. But Ram Dass just was mischief. Absolute, total mischief. And I actually was, around the Tim situation, Tim Leary situation, you know, he was super mischievous. And the feeling I had also, he was mischief with danger. So I had a warier relationship with Tim through the years. But with RD, it was just falling in love all of the time. And, you know, wherever we met, however we were, you know, teaching together, wherever we were playing, sitting at the breakfast table in Maui. And, you know, every year I would propose to him and he would flinch.
I thought he accepted a couple of times.
Well, no, the last time that I saw him, he proposed to me and I flinched. Yeah, it just anyway. Our precious friend, gone, but very present.
Very much so. So Ramesh?
Yes. Well, I didn't only met Ram Dass. I hadn't met Richard. I was at the first talk that he gave when he returned from India. He had done his master's degree in psychology with David McClelland, who you probably both know also or knew. And people who had been students of Ram Dass were by then teaching psychology at Wesleyan, and they wrote to him. This is after he'd been axed from Harvard, and asked him to come speak at Wesleyan. And he got the letter at the ashram in the Himalayas. So when he came back in early 1968, he agreed to come talk at Wesleyan. And everyone was thinking we were going to get the Better Living Through Modern Chemistry talk.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I got the guru from India. And this guy, you know, walks in this is March in New England, frozen mud. And he walks in barefoot in a white dress with a long beard. And he did not look like a Harvard professor anymore. And that talk started at 7 or 7:30 in the evening and went on until 3 in the morning.
Oh, my gosh.
When I got to India 2 years later, or 2.5 years later, I had the same feeling when I saw Maharaji, and it was so clear that he had come through Ram Dass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow, so interesting. So, I mean, in starting to read the book, it was so powerful for me, in part because it's also the story of an era. You know, Ram Dass was a pioneer and embodied so much of that particular time, which was such a powerful, transformative time in so many ways. And I thought of obviously the psychedelics and consciousness exploration and India, and later he was such a pioneer in working with people who were dying, working with people in prison, working with homeless people. For me, he was always the first one,
yeah,
doing that. Mm-hmm. And it was such a powerful sense reading this. It was like, oh yeah, that's like my youth, you know, and that's the time in this country that was so important.
It was also, you know, remember, it was tremendous political upheaval, not mm-hmm. so unlike right now, but
sure, the war in Vietnam was going on.
I had to get out of the draft before I could go to India.
Oh, wow.
Which I did. I got a psycho 4F.
Oh, yeah. I hesitate to ask you how you did that, but.
Well, why don't you tell us, Ramesh?
So I did get some letters from various, I cultivated various shrinks to get myself certified, but by then, I had been studying with Ram Dass and learning yoga and some meditation. So I got called and I went for a physical. And I'm standing around in my underwear with my mala beads for the pretty much all day, praying and doing Ram mantra with great intensity. And the shrink was the last person you get to in the line. And I think the guy who was doing that job was probably, you know, someone who was doing some medical student who was doing his alternative service as a draft board shrink. Mm-hmm. And by the time I got there, I could barely see him. I mean, I was pretty out there from doing mm-hmm. mantra with that intensity for that amount of time, which I am not the most assiduous sadhu. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so he wrote 1Y, which was the preliminary to 4F, which means you go after the women and children.
Oh,
gosh.
So I was certified crazy after. And I could go to India.
So in between
certified crazy,
I still am.
Yeah, in between meeting Ram Dass at Wesleyan and avoiding the draft, since you say your bio says you worked with him on Be Here Now, you must have developed
I had a minor role on Be Here Now. I mean, I did photographs and some of the remote work on it to put together the package. You know, it was in that pizza box from Mama Foundation originally.
Yeah.
And it came along with all kinds of graphics and photographs, which was some of the part that I worked on. And after it sold out, it turned into a book. And there's a whole saga around that. But and the book is Be Here Now, which is still up there in the bestsellers, you know, for spiritual books, I guess, at this point. It's amazing. It's keeps finding new generations of seekers.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. So after meeting Ram Dass at Wesleyan, did you follow him to New Hampshire or something?
Yeah. After the talk, he stayed over with the friends that he had known. And I went over to see him the next morning. And then I started driving up to New Hampshire to visit him. And he taught me yoga and meditation as he'd learned it in India. And that was my introduction to Maharaji. And there were two summer camps at their family farm in, I guess, 68 and 69. And there were maybe 30 or 40 people, but we were camping up in the woods and on George Alpert's farm above the three-hole golf course. And Danny Goldman was, you know, mowing the lawn on the tractor. Yeah. And it was quite a scene. And then on the weekends, hordes of people would come up the driveway and Ram Dass would give talks under a tree.
Mm.
Yeah, Ramesh, I wanted to ask you about Artie's dad. I mean, what do you think his take was on this whole scene that developed at the farm?
He was astonishingly open and generous. I mean, he could have been uptight and not, you know, it was an invasion. It was basically a home invasion and by, you know, a gang of crazed hippies. And he was just amazingly open. He used to, when I was up visiting, he would often take everybody out for dinner to the local Italian place that he liked. And I don't think he understood an iota of what was going on, but it was because it was so foreign to him coming out of a Jewish background. And he was a lawyer and had been a CEO of the New Haven Railroad. And he was from a different era entirely. But I think it was so loving and open that he felt that.
Well, you've got to think his son has already been fired from Harvard. Goes to India, comes back wearing a dress, you know.
Yep.
And it's a great image always of George's dad meeting him at the airport. And
yeah, says, himself. Quick, get in the car before somebody sees you.
Yeah, really. And then, you know, just these hordes of people arriving. And I should also say it was a time of such huge turmoil in the country. You're right. Like, the war in Vietnam was going on. There was the draft, which was a terrifying proposition. There was, you know, it's almost like these breakthrough times with all the stress and the alienation and families. And it was just like a lot going on. And then there were these respites, you know, like that farm, which was a family farm, and where people apparently would go and do headstands and things like that.
Yeah, there is a little bit of footage from that summer. Some of it is in that film Sunseed.
Uh-huh.
And there was a couple that came up and made a film about Ram Dass called Evolution of a Yogi. And First of all, we were also astonishingly young.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah. Somehow.
It certainly happened fast.
Yeah. Dreamlike. It's very dreamlike.
But there were real seeds of, things that were sown in the culture, I think, at that time.
Oh,
and one of those summers was the summer of Woodstock, which was only a few hours away.
Yeah.
And a couple of people defected for the weekend to
go to Woodstock.
To go to Woodstock, yeah.
But it's almost as though the scene at the farm prefigured Woodstock.
Yeah. Well, on a personal note, I would like to say I was at Woodstock.
Really?
Yes, indeed. But I was not at the farm.
Did you get breakfast in bed from Wavy Gravy?
Yeah, I did. In the mud. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. He saved us. He fed us.
Yeah.
But I didn't meet Ram Dass until my first retreat, which was in India in January of 1971. He was back in India after going back to the States. He returned and we were all sitting with this Burmese teacher, S.N. Goenka, who had just left Burma and was teaching an intensive 10-day insight meditation retreat. So that was my first exposure to meditation. And the pizza box from Lama Foundation that had been here now arrived when we were all there together. And I can remember, Ram Dass getting it and we're all looking at it. And it was like, it was just like this amazing moment in time.
Yeah. And a seminal one, as it turned out.
Yeah.
You know, when you track the people that were at that retreat, there are certainly a number of you, IMS came out of that. And
Definitely.
Mirabai's work, Mirabai Bush was there, and Danny Goleman's managed to do his Harvard thesis on meditation coming out of that retreat.
Yeah. It was kind of extraordinary and a long time ago, which is also just a further reflection on how very strange. So in those days, Ram Dass was Ram Dass because he had already been to India and met his guru named Karoli Baba, who's also known as Maharaji. And what do you think the thing, Ramesh, is like, as I've heard and read in the book, when Maharaji told Ram Dass to leave India, 2 years prior to our meeting or however long ago that was. And he said, don't tell anyone about me. And then Ram Dass proceeded to tell everyone about him.
Well, he was sort of, he was treading carefully on the boundaries of that. He couldn't talk about anything else for one thing, but he didn't give people Maharaji's name or where he was.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And, some people figured that out for themselves. And he allowed me and Krishnadas and Danny Goleman to write to the guy who had been his translator when he first met Maharaji, K.K. Sah, Krishna Kumar Sah, who was this very sweet Indian he and Ram Dass remained almost like brothers and guru brothers, really. And he died just a month after Ram Dass.
Yeah.
But so we wrote to KK, and KK took our letters to Maharaji. And we later found out that when KK put the letters in front of Maharaji and explained what they were, and Maharaji said, what do I have to do with these people? Tell them not to come. And KK interceded. He was feeding Maharaji an apple, and he stopped feeding him the apple, and he kind of put his head down and pouted, which KK was quite adept at when he wanted to. And he, Maharaji said, okay, finally saw that KK was disturbed and said, all right, what's the matter? And KK said, Maharaji, they're Ram Dass students. I can't tell them not to come. Mm-hmm. And Maharaji, this went back and forth for a while. And finally, Maharaji said, okay, tell them anything you want. And KK wrote to us and said something along the line of, Maharaji does not encourage anyone to come, but his doors are always open.
Oh, nice.
That was a mistake.
And that was all we needed.
Oh, gosh, that is so gorgeous. You know, Ramesh, in reading this book, which, by the way, I want to mention again, is a beautiful physical object. I mean, you know, you hold it, you look at its cover, the feeling of the whole presentation of the book is just wonderful.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
But I want to say reading it is something else. You know, I am in awe of how you were able to draw these stories out of R.D., who was so seriously aphasic.
Yeah.
You know, how did you do that?
Slowly.
You know, the gaps between thoughts and words were not insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love what Wavy said about him, that he used to be the master of the one-liner and he became the master of the ocean liner. Yeah, well, it was a long process, and I certainly used it as an excuse to spend more time with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurred over about 10 years. And honestly, I talked him into doing it because he didn't really want to.
Oh, really? You know,
mm-hmm. He's Mr. Live in the Moment, Be Here Now. You know, looking back at the past was not really on his main menu. But we got around to seeing it as a project where he could look back at his life through Maharaji's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the tact that we took with it. And as we got into it, I think he found it really valuable as a way of kind of not just excavating his past, but of releasing it, especially some of the old family stuff that he had kind of, you know, not dealt with entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went back through some of the, you know, really crucial experiences, like his first psilocybin trip and meeting Maharaji and his mother's death, he really found a lot of new territory in those experiences, and I think a different view of them in some ways that were very insightful. And I think he enjoyed that process. I mean, we had a great time doing it together. We laughed a lot. It was, I don't know if that comes through very well, but.
You know, in reading the about his trips, so to speak, I mean, I actually felt like I was experiencing a contact high. It was really fascinating, you know, to be in his, you know, this kind of perspective taking or mind reading or sort of empathic resonance mm-hmm. with him. And, you know, suddenly, you know, I felt like I was tripping, reading, you know, not only the arc of the experience, but also, you know, you just did, Ramesh, such a masterful job of bringing a coherent language into this, you know, into his expressions. So I think it's a remarkable book. I mean, it's so evocative. You know, you could really, I felt like not only, you know, I went on his trips, but I also.
Which you did a bit anyway.
Well, that's true. But also, you know, reading this particular narrative that you crafted with him was compelling. It's brilliant, I have to say, totally brilliant. You know, and delving into his parents' lives and, you know, also how he somehow, you know, was able to, and also again, through your relationship with him, evoke his mother's internal experience.
Mm.
Because he's talked so often about her, almost like the Dalai Lama speaks about his mother. But, you know, there was another side to her, which I hadn't really been in touch with until I read the book. And I thought, oh, yeah, there's a much wider spectrum of life experience, of light and darkness in his relationship with his mother and what his mother's experience was.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know even what he experienced of some of that, but it clarified things about his character to me also as we were going through that. I mean, especially his relationship with his mother.
Well, I concur. I think it's an amazing book, and you've done what every person writing a biography or an autobiography or a memoir aspires to, which is in a way it becomes everyone's story. I mean, not in the particulars, of course, you know, but it evokes things within us about challenge, about daring, about ridicule, about, you know, about all kinds of things. And he was so symbolic in so many ways of that time. And I would say he really, you know, something you said earlier, Ramesh, he was really responsible in so many ways for the creation of a center like the Insight Meditation Society in a couple of different ways. One is that my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, came back from India about 6 months before I did. And he was traveling across the country with some friends, and he stopped in Boulder where Naropa Institute had just opened an office. It was going to that summer launch, its first actual, you know, program. And he says that he stopped in the office and he asked if they might be interested in him teaching a course. He'd been in India for like 7 or 8 years. He'd practiced, he'd studied, his own teacher told him to teach. And they said, no, not really. You know, what they said was it being founded by Trungpa Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan. They said, we already have this Theravada named Jack Kornfield. That's enough.
Yeah.
So, you know, so Joseph went on to Berkeley. And as he tells the story, he called Ramdas because we had all met and become friends in India. And Ramdas had some very forbidding message on his answering machine, as was in those days, like, not talking to anybody, you know, don't leave a message, something like that. And Joseph went off to Telegraph Avenue and ended up needing to use a bathroom and went into a cafe, and they said no, only for customers. And to this day, I think, why did he like buy a muffin or something like that? But instead, he went to another cafe, and there was Ramdas, so they sat down and talked, and Ramdas was about to go to Boulder to teach this mega class at Naropa Institute of like 1,000 people. And he had these little divisions, like the chanting division led by Krishnadas.
We were all his teaching assistants.
That's right. So he said to Joseph, do you want to teach the meditation one, the meditation subgroup? So Joseph said yes. So that was Joseph's first teaching job in the States. And everything was born from there. And then when we were, you know.
And you went to camp on his living room floor.
I did. Yeah, I came back, you know, from India, and Joseph was living in student housing at Naropa, you know, at the Institute, which is what everyone was doing. Jack was living down the hall, and several of us decided, as is true, Joseph's the only one of our friends, you know, close friends, who has a job in an apartment. Let's all go to Boulder. So we went to Boulder, and it, literally at one point, nine of us moved into his one-bedroom apartment, and which was torture for Joseph. You know, Joseph, and what'd you do?
Yes.
And the way he tells the story was he really suffered until he finally let go of the thought that it was his apartment. And then we're all just living together. So then it was fine. And that was about 2 weeks before the end of the first summer session. And I stayed on for the second session where Joseph was teaching. I was his teaching assistant. Mm. And then it all happened from there. And then when we were thinking of...
Is that when you met Jack also?
Yeah, that's when I met Jack. He was living down the hall. And other people were there. Mark Epstein was there as a student. You know, it was like another one of those moments in time that was really important. And when we were thinking of starting a center years later, you know, Ramdas was kind of the chief cheerleader. And I don't think much would have happened without him. And I think we can say, because he was a pioneer, you know, in fields like Roshi being with dying, and he played a very important role in so many things.
It's interesting, when I went back to look at some of the Be Here Now text, when you read the what he put down about yoga practice at that mm-hmm. time, that was I think a great deal of the basis of what has become yoga in the States, because mm-hmm. it was very clear. It was a very simple Ashtanga practice, and it was also integrated pranayama and meditation and the yamas and niyamas. It was really the whole mm-hmm. Yoga system laid out. And it was, you know, now that yoga is in every community in the country, mm-hmm. practically, mm-hmm. it really, you can see the way those seeds sprouted.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the other piece that I feel is so critical is his involvement in the end-of-life care field.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in the prison work. You know, I think that, quote, spiritual people, not speaking about, say, Thich Nhat Hanh and Joanna Macy, but, you know, the sort of run-of-the-mill spiritual person is, you know, probably somewhat dissociated from social and environmental responsibility. Mm-hmm. And he just laid it straight in the middle of his into the middle of his world. And, you know, he brought, of course, this work to Dale Borglum, who did, you know, the wonderful mm-hmm. Living Dying Project. Still Stan and I were completely lit by by what he was doing, you know, because we were doing the LSD-assisted psychotherapy with people dying of cancer. And, you know, we were reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and we mm-hmm. were, you know, looking at what RD was saying about, you know, these explorations in consciousness. And, you know, later for me, his work in the prison system made it possible for me to take this jump here in New Mexico to working in the penitentiary of New Mexico. It just seems so logical to bring this kind of practice into the world of so-called corrections. But he was the pioneer. He was the instigator, the inspirator.
Yeah, and that one is still going also. That prison ashram project is still being run by Sita Lozoff in North Carolina. And but I think that it came from, you know, Maharaji was pretty down to earth in his instruction. And basically, it was love, serve, remember, from the beginning. And that service part, I mean, he named Ram Dass servant of God, of Ram. And we're all in the, you know, all the Dasses are mm-hmm. in the servant class.
Yeah, and, it's, you know, it became a, not just a social meme, but a global meme. You know, it wasn't just for, you know, the Neem Karoli Baba Ram Dass clan, so to speak. I mean, that.
Yeah, no, that quickly vanished into oblivion because Ram Dass was so eclectic.
Yeah.
And I think that even in the retreats on Maui in these later years, this combination of Buddhism and bhakti and wisdom and love have been so powerful, that coming together of so many traditions and without, you know, trying to turn it into some cult or, I mean, we are a cult, I guess.
Yeah, I would say, excuse me.
I'm happy to be in that cult. What did Bhagwan Das at one point called it? The Naked Mind Sect.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, my gosh. So I'm curious, Ramesh, you know, what is the one thing that got left out of the book that you wish had been in there?
Hadn't really thought about that one.
I have to skip to the end of the book now to see what I would have wanted to see in there. Maybe it's already in there.
Tell me.
Well, you know, one of the striking experiences, which I actually quote a lot these days, of being in Maui, which is where Ram Dass moved ultimately after his stroke and didn't really leave, and except I guess months right toward the end of his life. But and we would, you know, co-teach these retreats, and in those years, those last years, he was so made of light and so transparent, and and it was just awesome, you know. Given as Jones said, Roshi Jones said, his, you know, his aphasia was significant, and here was somebody who'd had really like a golden tongue. This was his magical power. Was his ability?
Yeah, he was a storyteller.
And you know, then there was all this hesitation, and there was all those pauses, and he was living in a wheelchair, and there was, you know, all the physical pain and whatever, but he was like made of love. It was just extraordinary. And one of my strong memories from one of those retreats was I was sitting way in the back of like 350 people, and Ram Dass was speaking, and he said, with a lot more pauses than I'm about to do, you know, the hardest thing after my stroke, harder than the physical pain, harder than the difference in my ability to speak, harder than anything, was having to accept help.
Yeah.
And he said it was the hardest thing and the most liberating. And he went on to say, one of my famous books is called How Can I Help? Now I feel like writing a book called How Can You Help Me? and I thought, oh, you know, that's interesting, that sense of him being so transparent. It's almost like there was a barrier within before, where it was so much easier for him to give than to receive.
Yeah.
And when that barrier collapsed or dissolved, then it was just like there was nothing in the way. And I quote that a lot, Roshi, is, you know, as you do, I work some amount with caregivers, and the very nature of their being, whether they're caregiving someone at home or professionally, is that giving.
Yeah.
And it can be so much harder to receive. And I thought, oh, yeah. he even modeled that toward the end.
Yeah. He was in the ICU a couple of years ago, and Frank Ostaseski and I were supposed to do a program on what was it called? The Grace of Mortality or the Blessing of Mortality or like that. And, you know, Frank and I land in Maui and, you know, go to the hospital. And there he is. He'd just been, you know, taken out of the ICU into a regular room, but has just incredible edema on one side of his body. Mm. He's almost died. Frank and I are looking at each other like, well, I guess we get to do this thing without our buddy here. And then later that day, he got discharged, came back to the house, and Frank and I are there. And he's tired. He goes to bed. And the next morning, we're all having breakfast, and he says, in his aphasic, mischievous way, I'll be doing that program with you.
Ooh. Frank
and I looked at each other like, oi, gewalt. Are you kidding? This is incredible. So, you know, we had revised the program, so it would be just Frank and me. We re-revised it, and we sort of set it up so it wouldn't be too taxing on Baba. And then the first evening, I remember we were in the program was going to happen in the Makawao Church. The church was jammed, and it was raining like heck. And we pulled up in front of the church, got into the parking lot, into the place where, you know, he could get unloaded in with his wheelchair. And he was definitely not well physically, but he was so present. And there was the usual kirtan at the beginning, and then he got rolled in by Dasi, and there's Frank and I following behind and so on toward the stage, wheelchair put on the stage. And he actually couldn't say anything. And I just remember this sitting up on either side of him, Frank and I, with him in the middle, up on that stage. And it was the purest darshan I have ever experienced. He was just emanating loving awareness. And it went on for, I don't know, an hour and a half. And I was just stunned. It was so powerful. It was so totally transmissional. And then we went back home. And Frank and I looked at each other, and it was just so clear that he was teaching us about what it really is to be with dying. And he, you know, it's like we didn't have to talk. Nobody was talking. We were just in the field of pure presence. And of course, the place was just filled with young people. And I thought, wow, you don't have to bring language into this. He is the teaching is so powerful about what it is to awaken beyond language.
It was it is like a field. It still is that field, I think. As Sharon was saying, you know, the intimacy of that space and the love that he emanated, radiated, however you want to say that, was so profound. The intimacy that was between him and his caregivers, so that I think they often felt like they were receiving more even than they were giving, even though they were taking care of his most intimate body functions, because he just couldn't, especially, you know, in the last year or so, it was hard for him to do anything. And he was, but that acceptance and that openness to where he was, I think I was at the end of the book. I was quoting the end of the Heart Sutra, that the form is the form of the formless. The formless is no other than form. And he was living in that.
You know, Ramesh, I am so grateful you included this last photograph in the book. And the last photograph of him before he died, of him, if you will, pointing, was it to Baba or to heaven or to space? It is such an incredible image.
Yeah, I love that one. It's I don't know whether he's pointing or it's the sub-ek, the all one finger of the, you know, you can take that however it comes to you.
Well, he's just translucent, but he's in that image. But one of the things is, you can, I mean, he has, you feel that he has merged with boundlessness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's merged with space. He's in the the very last syllable of the Heart Sutra.
Wow. And on that note, Ramesh, I'm wondering if you would be able to lead us in a short meditation practice, sort of based on Ram Dass's transmission to us all.
Well, I'll give it a try. It's going to be, as he often did, just winging it. And let's see if he wants to join us. you know, his the meditations that he led toward the end were just, he started out with, I am loving awareness. And over time, it began to continue to evolve into just the I am kind of disappeared, and it was just loving awareness. Mm-hmm. And love and awareness, I think those two parts of his being, that incredibly wise, conscious being who had been through psychology and psychedelics and Indian philosophy in such depth, and then had come to rest in the heart. So as we sit together, let's just let our mind sink into the heart. And if you want to come into your breath around the center of your chest and the diaphragm, then just allow yourself to relax into that, into the rising and falling of the breath. And just be with it. And let yourself rest in that heart space. And in that merging into love. That was the place that Ram Dass was absorbed into. And what he was calling the ocean of love. And allow the edges of our being to blur and to merge into that oneness. That oneness that we all share, that heart space. That isn't one or another of us, that's just Ram. The great heart space, the heart mind, where we're just the breath. What Maharaji said of Hanuman at one point, he said he's the breath of Ram. May we all serve as the breath of Ram. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today, and Ram Dass, who came by, no doubt. To learn more about the book, Being Ram Dass, you can visit www.beingramdass.com. That's www.beingramdass.com. Or find yourself a copy wherever books are sold. And a big thank you to all of you who've been listening. This has been the Meta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at SharonSalzberg.com.